One night during the bombardment, Krieger called me, he said, "Eugen, come here." He led me to his room in the kitchen block. Everything in his room was disheveled. He had a portrait of Hitler, the huge frame behind the glass. And that portrait fell down, and as he came in the room, I was following him, he came up and put his heavy boot into the Hitler's face, smashing the glass and swearing his usual Schweinhund, you know, blah, 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 blah. Then he turned to me and said, "Eugen, halt dein Mund zu," which meant, "Eugene, keep your mouth shut." Jawohl, Herr Krieger.
Hello and welcome to Verbatim. I'm Michelle Rayner. Today we present the second part of the wartime experience of Eugene Wilson, who came to Australia after the Allied liberation of Germany in the wake of World War II. In last week's program, Eugene Wilson told interviewer Brian McKenzie about the German invasion of his village in Ukraine and the friendship that he developed with a German soldier who came to stay in his house, Dr. Richard Zimmerman. At the close of last week's episode, Eugene Wilson had been rounded up and, with some of the other men from the village, put on a train bound for a German labour camp in Berlin. Here's part two of Eugene Wilson's story. Goodbye, Ukraine.
Every morning about 4 o'clock, you had to dress and get your coffee, so-called coffee. The coffee was just burned oats, and there was always commotion in the kitchen hall because everyone tried to be the last to get the coffee in hope to get some residue of burned oats. And policemen was running around with a rubber hose, you know, hurry up, lost. We had to line up in the middle of the camp, 4 abreast. We will march out of the camp, arrive at the station. There will be a special train, so-called Sonderzug, will arrive non-stop till Warschauer Straße. That was the station in Berlin where our factory was. I was put as a helper to a German worker. Our job was to clean the wheels of good trains. The work was so difficult physically. If you imagine being perpetually hungry and such a heavy work that I barely could last a day. And when we will arrive back in the camp, I will just fall on my bed and, you know. I knew that I wouldn't last very long at this particular job. As we would pass through the residential street of the Kaulsdorf, some would ring the bells just simply to wake up Germans. So, of course, there were a lot of complaints. Herr Krieger will be shouting that you so and so and so, you are ringing the bells while you're going to the railway station, so if we'll catch anyone, we'll shoot on the spot. Herr Krieger probably was typical German. Very often, proudly, he would remind that his name, Krieger, in Russian was Voinov, which means he is a fighter. Quite often he would remind us that his name was Voinov, that, because it was ironical having a name of Krieger, real fighter, but he had something wrong with his feet. His knees hardly would bend. He would just shuffle instead of lifting his feet. So that prevented him, of course, to be called up in the army. His guidelines were discipline, order, and punctuality. And above all, work. Dr. Schnell, German doctor, she spoke very well Russian. She used to come once a month in camp to have a look at all those that could not work anymore. In my childhood, I had a problem with my heart. And I find that difficulty to perform heavy work, so I would like to work in camp. If she could recommend me to Herr Krieger. They called me in the office, and Herr Krieger said, "You would like to work in a camp?" I said, "Yes, if it's possible." "Okay, you work in the kitchen." So from this point on, I was working in the camp. One day, there is a new batch of girls have arrived in the camp. At that time, I was working in the kitchen already. And that's how I saw Tanya in the queue, standing for a soup. Well, she immediately drew my attention, and I think from that point on, my heart started to improve. The rule was that after 8 o'clock, no man should be in a women's barracks. In front of Tanya's bed, there was a curtain. And we were sitting there behind the curtain talking. And suddenly I heard Herr Krieger came in, and I could hear his voice. As he put one hand on the end of the curtain to open it, I tried to sneak behind the other end. He saw me immediately, and I felt this whack between my shoulders. So I had to run. There was the end of 1942. A German army got booked at Stalingrad. Battle of Stalingrad was a turning point in the Second World War. So eventually German army was defeated and started to roll back. At this time, bombardments of Germany was increased. At night, we used to have English bombers coming and bombing. American bombers would come and bomb Berlin during the daytime. Every one of us who was working in the kitchen through the night, we had the orders from Herr Krieger immediately to wake him up as soon as there is a news through the so-called German Drahtfunk, which is wired transmission. Now, one interesting point was we had to wake him up only when the danger level was 15. In other words, German radio used to transmit Achtung, Achtung, Luftgefahr, Stufe 15. Attention, attention, the air danger is stage 15. Bombers are approaching Berlin. Because that news gone right through the city and all defense. You could hear through the night and through the day on this particular communication net what was happening in the air. But when it was announced that danger stage is 15, so once you hear that, you immediately run to Herr Krieger's room, knock on the door, "Herr Krieger, Stufe 15. So Herr Krieger will be on his feet, immediately dressed up. And then within a few minutes, you will start to hear sirens all over the Berlin. Initially, when the night bombardments of Berlin started, the police used to run through the barracks and getting everyone out. Of course, there was nowhere else to go. And we just stood there outside, you know, and watching what's happening in the sky. Very often watching light blinds shot down and, you know, falling on the city. Towards 1944, bombardment of Berlin were perpetual. 10 o'clock in the morning, by 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 10, 11 at night, 3, 4 in the morning. One night, we heard the approaching bombers coming towards us, towards the Karlsdorf. You could hear it. Within 10, 15 minutes, the camp was sprinkled with eccentrics. Wooden barracks caught fire immediately, and three-quarter of the camp burned out within next half an hour. We couldn't do anything. Tanya's barrack burned down. Administration barrack burns down. The only survived was, unfortunately, bloody police barrack. People were running around. One or two of reminding barracks caught a fire. we tried to extinguish it, but it was pointless. So anyway, in those 15 or 20 minutes, everything was burned down.
While he was in the labour camp in Berlin, Eugene decided that he would try to meet the mother of his German friend, Richard Zimmermann. The two had met earlier on in the war when Zimmermann, a compassionate young doctor, had boarded with Eugene and his mother after the Germans invaded their village.
He wrote to his mother that if you get visit from Eugene, and probably he explained who was I, make sure that you feed him. So I approached Herr Krieger and explained to him what was going on. So he was a bit surprised. He said, all right, you can visit them. So one Sunday, I got on the train and gone to visit them. It was a multi-story house, one of those middle-class burger suburbs. When I got to the third floor, I found that Zimmermann family, there was a sign on the door. Pressed the button a few times, but there was no answer. Obviously, no one was there. As I was coming down, there was a lady going up, and she looked at me, sort of a stranger, and she said, can I help you? Who do you want to see here? And I said, I was trying to see Frau Zimmermann. She looked at me, and she said, I'm Frau Zimmermann, so would you come with me? So we gone upstairs. She opened the door, walked in, and she said to me, what's all about? As soon as I start to tell her that your son, Richard Zimmermann, was living with us, she immediately, she looked at me with the wide eyes, tears burst out of her eyes. She was crying, and then, anyway, she told me that Richard was missing somewhere in Romania. She kept on crying, and then she said to me, Eugen, I had two sons. One son was killed in Poland, another missing. So she said, we haven't got anyone in family left. She took me to one of the rooms, opened the wardrobe, and she said, this is all Richard's clothing. So it is yours now. In camp, we had a huge pile of briquettes. It seemed like German precision gone wrong somewhere. There was plenty of briquettes, no food. One day I went to Krieger and I said, Herr Krieger, can I take a few briquettes for Frau Zimmermann? So on each visit, I used to take about half a dozen. I had briquettes, wrapped them in a parcel. Tanya and myself, we used to visit Zimmermann's. And Frau Zimmermann always had a good meal for us there. For the Christmas of 1943-44, to our surprise, quite a quantity of schnapps was delivered to our camp, and each one of us received some 50 grams maybe or so, little dose of schnapps to celebrate the Christmas. It became more and more obvious that Germany had lost the war, and administration of the camp, including Herr Krieger, they were more often drunk. And through the night, we can hear was constant roar of the Russian artillery, and the horizon was always lit up. You could see it, it was not far away. I was walking across the camp, and suddenly I heard Krieger was calling my name. Eugen, come over here. So I come up and he said, come with me. We gone in his hut. And he said to me, Eugen, tell me what's going to happen to me when the Russians will come. So I said, Herr Krieger, I don't know. Well, he said, and put his hand in the pocket, drew out the gun, and it said, well, here it is. The 5 bullets for Russians, 1 for me. So I said, oh, Herr Krieger, I don't think it will be that bad. He turned around and reached for a bottle of schnapps, took 2 glasses, filled them in and handed one over to me. He said, well, let's have a drink. And he said, all right, we will see what's going to happen. And at this time, Frau Zimmermann has arranged for two railway tickets for us. And one morning, Tanya has prepared small suitcase with her belongings. I didn't have anything. And we just walked out of the camp, gone to the railway station, and was absolute chaos. It was a melee of refugees, wounded soldiers. People were trying to board the trains. And in the meantime, the Russian artillery was already bombarding Berlin. It was impossible to get to the train. Shells were falling on the glass roof of a station, exploding. Glass was flying everywhere. The station was filled with literally thousands and thousands of people. Everyone was trying to get out of Berlin. In all that melee of Russian people, we just gone downstairs, underground of railway station, and we spent night there. Early in the morning, we just edged our way to the upstairs to the platform. Now, this particular day, it was, it must have been 20th of April, which was a birthday of Adolf Hitler. And Russians were especially bombarding Berlin for the occasion as a birthday present. And there was a train arriving, and announcement was made that, ladies and gentlemen, this is a possibly last train out of Berlin, so please do board. I managed to push Tanya inside the carriage, and so eventually we got out of Berlin, and I remember it was a night. Train stopped somewhere in the field, and everyone had to get out. The train was not moving, it was not going ahead because the railway was bombed out. Now, here was the situation. It was absolute pitch dark. You couldn't see anything in front of you. So I remember people just hung up on each other, holding on each other, and all this mess of people was moving in a field which was full of craters, some were falling over and crying for help. We got in one of the trenches. I took my Zimmermann's overcoat, lied on the ground, Tanya lied with her small case on the ground, and I sort of edged myself alongside in that pitch black night. I looked out of the trench, and eastern horizon was ablaze. And I think that was the time when the actual battle for Berlin have started. I remember I was woke up by a woman's voice, and she said, would you like to have a cup of coffee? So we went with this woman across the field to her house. Then she asked us what nationality we were. And when I said that we were Russians, and husband of a lady, he was a railway worker. He said, well, look, here is a map. He told us how to get to the next station. He knew that the next train will be somewhere around the lunchtime. So when we arrived to the station, the train came in, and there was again that melee of people, of course, you know, refugees. When we got into the carriage, I pushed Tanya forward in front of me, and then when I climbed into the carriage, suddenly there was a gun pointed at my forehead. And I looked, it was a wounded German soldier, and there were quite a number of them. So we moved in a corner, and eventually the door was closed, dry and gone off. In a few hours, we have arrived at Lübeck. And the Russian army was going along the north coast of Germany, and the rumors were that they might even take the town. So we have decided to go for the west. We had traveled about 29 kilometers outside Lübeck and stopped in a small town, Bad Segeberg. Train was not going any further, so there was practically nowhere to stay. But fortunately, we met two Russian women, and they took us to the Shell service station. They live downstairs, and they said, you can stay with us, but you have to stay in the attic under the roof. We spent there, I don't remember how many days, but one morning we were woken up by loud clatter on the cobblestones of the street. I come down and I saw British tanks slowly rolling in the town. After the tanks, there was a marching Scottish regiment. It was very surprising to see the soldiers in the skirts with the bagpipes and the rifle over their shoulders marching into the town and playing this very old Scottish tune. The town was absolutely quiet. There was no single German in the street. Everyone hid. There was no shot fired. The town just quietly surrendered. And the border was established. It was 29 kilometers to the Russian border. In other words, the motherland was 29 kilometers from us.
Signed the act of unconditional surrender.
War was over, so we knew that our journey through the wartime came to the end. But the new danger loomed for us. At the Yalta conference, agreement was reached between the Allies that, as Stalin demanded, that all former Russian citizens will be forcefully repatriated to Soviet Union. So within a few days, there was, in this little town, Russian repatriation mission has arrived. They settled in one of the big houses in this little town. There were people who went voluntarily. They volunteered to go back to Russia, but there was a number of prisoners of war and the workers like us. They did not want to go back being afraid for their future. So to get the food, one has to register with United Nations Relief Organization. I went to their office and I remember I walked in the room. There was a gentleman in English uniform. I said to him that I would like to register as a refugee. He asked for my name and where I was born, what country I come from. I said that I come from Soviet Union. So he put his pencil down and he said, my dear fellow, do you want to go back to Russia? I said, no. Well, he said, think about it and come back tomorrow. So next day I saw him and he registered me. My place of birth was Latvia. Bloody Europe, we had a gut full of it, and Australia was the furthest place from it. So we decided to migrate to Australia. And when we came to Australia, I noticed something I had not seen since my childhood in Ukraine. The golden wheat fields waving in the cool breeze, stretching out to the horizon as if they would never end.
Eugene Wilson. He was interviewed by film producer Brian McKenzie. My thanks today to Eugene Wilson, to interviewer and producer Brian McKenzie, and to Chris Lawson and Carey Dell for technical production. I'm Michelle Rayner, and I hope you'll join us for more Verbatim, this time next week here on ABC Radio National. Right now, though, it's time for Street Stories.